and I am sure you will remember more the longer you stay within these walls. You may not have been fully aware of it at the time, but you spent most of your life in a room not far from here. This is your home, Sephira. It is where you belong, and it is where you will build your nest and lay your eggs." Sephira's eyes narrowed, and Aragorn felt a strange yearning from her, mixed with a burning hatred. The king moved on. "Arya Drotningu. Fate, it seems, has a sense of humor, for here you are, even as I ordered you to be brought so long ago. Your path was a roundabout one, but still you have come, and of your own accord. I find that rather amusing, don't you?" Arya pressed her lips together and refused to answer. Galbatorix chuckled. "I admit you have been a thorn in my side for quite some time now. You've not caused as much mischief as that bumbling meddler Brom, but neither have you been idle. One might even say that this whole situation is your fault, as it was you who sent Sephira's egg to Aragorn. However, I hold no enmity toward you. If not for you, Sephira might not have hatched, and I might never have been able to flush the last of my enemies from hiding. For that, I thank you. And then there is you, Elva, the girl with the sigil of a rider upon her brow, dragon-marked and blessed with the wherewithal to perceive all that pains a person, and all that will pain them. How you must have suffered these past months! How you must despise those around you for their weaknesses, even as you are forced to share in their misery! The Varden have used you poorly. Today I shall end the battles that have so tormented you, and you shall no longer have to endure the mistakes and misfortunes of others. That I promise. On occasion I may have need of your skill, but in the main you may live as you please, and peace shall be yours." Elva frowned, but it was obvious that the king's offer tempted her. Listening to Galbatorix, Aragorn realized, could be as dangerous as listening to Elva herself. Galbatorix paused and fingered the wire-wrapped hilt of his sword, while he regarded them with a hooded gaze. Then he looked past them, toward the point in the air where the Eldunari floated hidden from sight, and his mood seemed to darken. "Convey my words to Umaroth as I speak them," he said. "Umaroth, we are ill met once again. I thought I killed you on Vroengard." Umaroth responded, and Aragorn began to relay his words. "He says that you killed only his body," Arya finished.
"That much is obvious," said Galbatorix. "Where did the riders hide you and those with you? On Vroengard, or was it elsewhere? My servants and I searched the ruins of Doru Areba most closely."
Aragorn hesitated to deliver the dragon's answer, as it was sure to displease the king, but he could think of no other option. "He says that he will never share that information with you of his own free will." Galbatorix's eyebrows met above his nose.
"Does he now? Well, he'll tell me soon enough, whether he wishes to or not."
The king tapped the pommel of his glaringly white sword. "I took this blade from his rider, you know, when I killed him. When I killed Vrail, in the watchtower that overlooks Palancar Valley. Vrail had his own name for this sword. He called it Islinger, Lightbringer. I thought Vranger was more appropriate." Vranger meant awry, and Aragorn agreed that it fitted the sword better. A dull boom sounded behind them, and Galbatorix smiled again.
"Ah, good. Murtagh and Thorn shall be joining us shortly, and then we can begin properly."
Another sound filled the chamber, then a great
gusting noise that seemed to come from several directions at once. Galbatorix glanced over his shoulder and said, "It was inconsiderate of you to attack so early in the morning. I was already awake. I rise well before dawn. But you woke Shrewkin. He gets rather irritated when he's tired, and when he's irritated, he tends to eat people. My guards learned long ago not to disturb him when he's resting. You would have done well to follow their example." As Galbatorix spoke, the curtains behind his throne shifted and rose toward the ceiling. With a sense of shock, Aragorn realized that they were actually Shrewkin's wings. The black dragon lay curled on the floor, with his head close to the throne, the bulk of his massive body forming a wall too steep and too high for any to climb without magic. His scales had not the radiance of Saphira's or Thorn's, but rather sparkled with a dark, liquid brilliance. Their inky color made them almost opaque, which gave them an appearance of strength and solidity that Aragorn had not seen in a dragon's scales before. It was as if Shrewkin were plated with stone or metal, not gems. The dragon was enormous. Aragorn at first had difficulty comprehending that the entire shape before them was a single living creature. He saw part of Shrewkin's corded neck and thought he was seeing the main part of the dragon's body. He saw the side of one of Shrewkin's hind feet and mistook it for a shin. A fold of a wing was an entire wing in his mind. Only when he looked up and found the spikes atop the dragon's spine did Aragorn grasp the full extent of Shrewkin's size. Each spike was as wide as the trunk of an ancient oak tree. The scales surrounding them were a foot thick, if not more. Then Shrewkin opened an eye and looked down at them. His iris was a pale blue-white, the color of a high mountain glacier, and it appeared startlingly bright amid the black of his scales. The dragon's huge, slitted orb darted back and forth as he studied their faces. His gaze seemed to contain nothing but fury and madness, and Aragorn felt certain that Shrewkin would kill them in an instant if Galbatorix allowed it. The stare of the enormous eye, especially when it held such evident malice, made Aragorn want to run and hide in a burrow deep, deep underground. It was, he imagined, very much how a rabbit must feel when confronted by a large, toothy creature. Beside him, Saphira growled, and the scales along her back rippled and lifted like hackles. In response, jets of fire appeared in the yawning pits of Shrewkin's nostrils, and then he growled as well, drowning out Saphira and filling the chamber with a rumble like that of a rock slide. On the dais, the two children squeaked and curled into balls, tucking their heads between their knees. "Peace, Shrewkin," said Galbatorix, and the black dragon grew silent again. His eyelid descended, but it did not close completely. The dragon continued to watch them through a gap a few inches wide, as if waiting for the right moment to pounce. "He does not like you," said Galbatorix. "But then he does not like anyone, do you now, Shrewkin?" The dragon snorted, and the smell of smoke tinged the air. Hopelessness again overwhelmed Aragorn. Shrewkin could kill Saphira with a bat of his paw, and as large as the chamber was, it was still too small for Saphira to evade the great black dragon for long. His hopelessness turned to frustrated rage, and he wrenched at his invisible bonds. "How is it you can do this?" he shouted, straining every muscle in his body. "I would like to know that as well," said Arya. Galbatorix's eyes seemed to gleam beneath the dark eaves of his brow.
"Can you not guess, Elfling?"
"I would prefer an answer to a guess," she replied.
"Very well. But first you must do something, so that you may know that what I say is indeed the truth. You must try to cast a spell, both of you, and then I shall tell you." When neither Aragorn nor Arya made to speak, the king gestured with his hand, Go on. I promise that I will not punish you for it. Now try. I insist.
Arya went first. Thrautha, she said, her voice hard and low. She was, Aragorn guessed, trying to send the Dauthdert flying toward Galbatorix. The weapon, however, remained fixed to her hand. Then Aragorn spoke.
Brisinger!
He thought that perhaps his bond with his sword would allow him to use magic where Arya could not. But to his disappointment, the blade remained as it was, glittering dimly in the dull light of the lanterns. Galbatorix's gaze grew more intense.
The answer must be obvious to you now, Elfling. It has taken me most of the past century, but at long last I have found what I was searching for. A means of governing the spellcasters of Alagazia. The search was not easy. Most men would have given up in frustration, or if they had the required patience, fear. But not I. I persisted, and through my study, I discovered what I had for so long desired. A tablet written in another land and another age, by hands that were neither elf nor dwarf nor human nor Urgle. And upon that tablet there was scribed a certain word, a name that magicians throughout the ages have hunted for with nothing but bitter disappointment as their reward.
Galbatorix lifted a finger.
The name of all names. The name of the ancient language.
Aragorn bit back a curse. He had been right.
That's what the Razak was trying to tell me, he thought,
remembering what one of the insect-like monsters had said to him in Helgrind.
He has almost found the name, the true name.
As disheartening as Galbatorix's revelation was, Aragorn clung to the knowledge that the name could not stop him or Arya, or Saphira for that matter, from using magic without the ancient language. Not that it would do much good. The king's wards were sure to protect him and Shrookan from any spells they might cast. Still, if the king did not know that it was possible to use magic without the ancient language, or even if he did, but he believed that they did not, then they might be able to surprise him and maybe distract him for a moment. Although Aragorn was not sure how that might help. Galbatorix continued,
"With this word, I can reshape spells as easily as another magician by command the elements. All spells shall be subject to me, but I am subject to none, except for those of my choosing."
Perhaps he doesn't know,
Aragorn thought, a spark of determination kindling in his heart.
I shall use the name of names to bring every magician in Alagazia to heel, and no one shall cast a spell but with my blessing, not even the elves. At this very moment, the magicians of your army are discovering the truth of this. Once they venture a certain distance into Urabain, past the front gate, their spells cease to work as they should. Some of their enchantments fail outright, while others twist and end up affecting your troops instead of mine.
Galbatorix tilted his head, and his gaze grew distant, as if he were listening to someone whispering in his ear.
It has caused much confusion among their ranks.
Aragorn fought the urge to spit at the king.
It doesn't matter, he growled. We'll still find a way to stop you.
Galbatorix seemed grimly amused.
Is that so? How? And why? Think what you are saying. You would stop the first opportunity that Alagazia has had for true peace in order to sate your overdeveloped sense of vengeance? You would allow magicians everywhere to continue to have their way, regardless of the harm they cause others. That seems far worse than anything I have done. But this is idle speculation. The finest warriors of the Riders could not defeat me, and you are far from their equal. You never had any hope of overthrowing me. None of you did.
I killed Durza, and I killed Arazak, said Aragorn.
Why not you?
I am not as weak as those who serve me. You could not even trounce Murtagh, and he is but a shadow of a shadow. Your father Morzan was far more powerful than either of you, and even he could not withstand my might.
Besides, said Galbatorix, as a cruel expression settled on his face, you are mistaken if you think you destroyed the Razak. The eggs in Dras Leona weren't the only ones I took from the Leatherblucker. I have others hidden elsewhere. Soon they shall hatch, and soon the Razak shall once more roam the earth to do my bidding. As for Durza, shades are easy to make, and they are often more trouble than they are worth. So you see, you have won nothing, boy. Nothing but false victories.
Above all, Aragorn hated Galbatorix's smugness and his air of overwhelming superiority. He wanted to rage at the king and curse him with every oath he knew. But for the sake of the children's safety, he held his tongue. "Do you have any ideas?" he asked Saphira, Arya, and Glada.
"No,"
said Saphira. The others remained silent. "Umaroth?"
"Only that we should attack while we still can."
A minute passed wherein no one spoke. Galbatorix leaned on one elbow and rested his chin on his fist while he continued to watch them. By his feet, the boy and the girl cried softly. Above, Shrukan's eye remained fixed on Aragorn and those with him, like a great ice-blue lantern. Then they heard the doors to the chamber open and close, and the sound of approaching footsteps. The footsteps of both a man and a dragon. Murtagh and Thorn soon appeared in their field of vision. They stopped next to Saphira, and Murtagh bowed.
"Sir."
The king motioned, and Murtagh and Thorn walked over to the right of the throne. As Murtagh took up his position, he gave Aragorn a look of disgust. Then he clasped his hands behind his back and stared toward the far end of the chamber, ignoring him.
"You took longer than I expected," said Galbatorix, in a deceptively mild voice.
Without looking, Murtagh said, "The gate was more damaged than I originally thought, sir, and the spells you placed on it made it difficult to repair."
"Do you mean that it's my fault you are tardy?"
Murtagh's jaw tightened. "No, sir, I only mean to explain. Also, part of the hallway was rather messy, and that slowed us."
"I see. We shall speak of this later. But for now, there are other matters we must attend to. For one, it is time our guests meet the final member of our party. Moreover, it is high time we had some proper light in here."
And Galbatorix struck the flat of his blade against one arm of his throne, and in a deep voice he cried,
"Nain!"
At his command, hundreds of lanterns sprang to life along the walls of the chamber, bathing it with warm, candle-like illumination. The room was still dim about the corners, but for the first time, Aragorn could make out the details of their surroundings. Scores of pillars and doorways lined the walls, and all about were sculptures and paintings and gilt scrollwork. Gold and silver had been used with abundance, and Aragorn glimpsed the sparkle of many jewels. It was a staggering display of wealth, even when compared with the riches of Tronchim or Ellesmira. After a moment, he noticed something else. A block of grey stone, granite perhaps, 8 feet tall, which stood off to their right, beyond where the light had previously reached. And chained, standing to the block, was Nasuwada, wearing a simple white tunic. She was watching them with wide-open eyes, though she could not speak, for a knotted cloth was tied over her mouth. She looked worn and tired, but otherwise healthy.
Relief shot through Aragorn. He had not dared hope to find her alive.
Nasawada! He shouted. Are you all right?
She nodded.
Has he forced you to swear fealty to him?
She shook her head.
Do you think I would let her tell you if I had? Asked Galbatorix.
As Aragorn looked back at the king, he saw Murtagh cast a quick, concerned glance toward Nasawada, and he wondered at its significance.
Well, have you?
Aragorn asked in a challenging tone.
As it so happens, no. I decided to wait until I had gathered all of you together. Now that I have, none shall leave until you have pledged yourself in service to me. Nor shall you leave until I have learned the true name of each and every one of you. That is why you are here. Not to kill me, but to bow down before me and to finally put an end to this noisome rebellion.
Saphira growled again, and Aragorn said,
We won't give in.
Even to his own ears, his words seemed weak and toothless.
Then they will die, Galbatorix replied, pointing at the two children. And in the end your defiance will change nothing.
You do not seem to understand you have already lost.
Outside, the battle fares badly for your friends. Soon my men will force them to surrender, and this war will arrive at its destined conclusion. Fight if you wish, deny what is before you if it comforts you, but nothing you do can change your fate, or that of Alagazia.
Aragorn refused to believe that he and Saphira would have to spend the rest of their lives answering to Galbatorix. Saphira felt the same, and her anger joined with his, burning away every last bit of his fear and caution. And he said, Ve weonata ono vergare, eka theat otherum. We will kill you, I swear it. For a moment Galbatorix appeared aggravated. Then he spoke the word again, as well as other words in the ancient language besides. And the vow Aragorn had uttered seemed to lose all meaning. The words lay in his mind like a handful of dead leaves, devoid of any power to impel or inspire. The king's upper lip curved in a sneer.
Swear all the oaths you want. They shall not bind you, not unless I allow them to.
I'll still kill you,
Aragorn muttered. He understood that if he continued to resist, it might mean the lives of the two children. But Galbatorix had to be killed, and if the price of his death was the deaths of the boy and the girl, then that was a cost Aragorn was willing to accept. He knew he would hate himself for it. He knew that he would see the faces of the children in his dreams for the rest of his life. But if he did not challenge Galbatorix, then all would be lost.
Do not hesitate, said Umaroth. Now is the time to strike.
Aragorn raised his voice.
Why won't you fight me? Are you a coward? Or are you too weak to match yourself against me? Is that why you hide behind these children like a frightened old woman?
Aragorn, said Arya in a warning tone.
I am not the only one who brought a child here today, replied the king, the lines on his face deepening.
There is a difference. Elva agreed to come. But you didn't answer the question. Why won't you fight? Is it that you've spent so long sitting on your throne and eating sweets that you've forgotten how to swing a sword?
You would not want to fight me, youngling, growled the king.
Prove it then. Release me and meet me in honest battle. Show that you are still a warrior to be reckoned with, or live with the knowledge that you are a sniveling coward who dares not face even a single opponent without the help of your Eldenari. You killed Vrail himself. Why should you fear me? Why should...
Enough, said Galbatorix.
A flush had crept into his hollow cheeks. Then, like Quicksilver, his mood changed, and he bared his teeth in a fearsome approximation of a smile. He rapped the arm of his seat with his knuckles. I did not gain this throne by accepting every challenge put to me, nor have I held it by meeting my foes in honest battle. What you have yet to learn, youngling, is that it does not matter how you achieve victory, only that you achieve it. You're wrong. It does matter, said Aragorn. I will remind you of that when you are sworn to me. However, Galbatorix tapped the pommel of his sword, since you wish so badly to fight, I will grant your request. The flare of hope that Aragorn felt vanished when Galbatorix added, But not with me, with Murtagh. At those words, Murtagh flashed an angry look at Aragorn. The king stroked the fringe of his beard. I would like to know once and for all which of you is the better warrior. You will fight as you are, without magic or Eldunari, until one of you is unable to continue. You may not kill each other, that I forbid. But short of death, I will allow most anything. It will be rather entertaining, I think, to watch brother fight brother. No, said Aragorn, not brothers, half-brothers. Brom was my father, not Morzan. For the first time, Galbatorix appeared surprised. Then one corner of his mouth twisted upward. Of course, I should have seen it. The truth is in your face for any who know what to look for. This duel will be all the more fitting, then. The son of Brom pitted against the son of Morzan. Fate indeed has a sense of humor. Murtagh also reacted with surprise. He controlled his face too well for Aragorn to determine whether the information pleased or upset him. But Aragorn knew that it had thrown him off balance. That had been his plan. If Murtagh was distracted, it would be that much easier for Aragorn to defeat him. And he did intend to defeat him, regardless of the blood they shared. Letter, said Galbatorix, with a slight motion of his hand. Aragorn staggered as the spell holding him vanished. Then the king said, Ganga Aptar, and Arya, Elva, and Saphira slid backward, leaving a wide space between them and the dais. The king muttered a few other words, and most of the lanterns in the chamber dimmed, so that the area in front of the throne was the brightest spot in the room. Come now, said Galbatorix to Murtagh. Join Aragorn, and let us see which of you is the more skilled. Scowling, Murtagh walked to a spot several yards from where Aragorn stood. He drew Zarok. The blade of the crimson sword looked as if it were already coated in blood, then lifted his shield and settled into a crouch. After glancing at Saphira and Arya, Aragorn did the same. Now fight, cried Galbatorix, and clapped his hands. Sweating, Aragorn began to move toward Murtagh, even as Murtagh moved toward him. Muscle against metal. Roran yelped and jumped aside as a brick chimney smashed into the ground in front of him, followed by the body of one of the Empire's archers. He shook the sweat from his eyes, then moved around the body and the pile of scattered bricks, hopping from one patch of open ground to the next, much as he used to hop along the stones by the Anora River. The battle was going badly, that much was obvious. He and his warriors had remained close to the outer wall for at least a quarter of an hour, fighting off the advancing waves of soldiers. But then they had allowed the soldiers to lure them back among the buildings. In retrospect, that had been a mistake. Fighting in the streets was desperate and bloody and confusing. His battalion had become spread out, and only a small number of his warriors remained close by, men from Carvajal mostly, along with four elves and several Urgals. The rest were scattered among the nearby streets, fighting on their own, without direction. Worse, for some reason that the elves and other spellcasters could not explain, magic no longer seemed to be working as it should. They had discovered this when one of the elves had tried to kill a soldier with a spell, only to have a Varden warrior fall down dead instead, consumed by the swarm of beetles the elf had summoned forth. His death had sickened Roran. It was a horrible, senseless way to die, and it might have happened to any of them. Off to their right, closer to the main gate, Lord Bast was still rampaging through the main body of the Varden's army. Roran had caught sight of him several times, on foot now, striding among the humans, elves and dwarves, and dashing them aside like so many ninepins with his huge black mace. No one had been able to stop the hulking man, much less wound him, and those around him scrambled to stay out of reach of his fearsome weapon. Roran had also seen King Oryk and a group of dwarves hewing their way through a group of soldiers. Oryk's jeweled helm flashed in the light as he swung his mighty warhammer, Volund. Behind him, his warriors shouted,
"For Oryk's Corner!"
50 feet past Oryk, Roran had glimpsed Queen Islanzadi whirling through the battle, her red cape flying, and her shining armor as bright as a star amid the dark mass of bodies. About her head had flitted the white raven that was her companion. What little Roran saw of Islanzadi impressed him with her skill, ferocity, and bravery. She reminded him of Arya, but he thought that the queen might be the greater warrior. A cluster of 5 soldiers charged around the corner of a house and nearly ran into Roran. Shouting, they leveled their spears and did their best to skewer him like a roast chicken. He ducked and dodged, and with his own spear caught one of the men in the throat. The soldier remained on his feet for a minute more, but he could not breathe properly, and soon he fell to the ground, tangling the legs of his companions. Roran seized the opportunity, stabbing and cutting with abandon. One of the soldiers managed to land a blow on Roran's right shoulder, and Roran felt the familiar decrease in his strength as his wards deflected the blade. He was surprised that the wards protected him. Only a few moments before, they had failed to stop the rim of a shield from tearing open the skin on his left cheek. He wished that whatever was happening with the magic would resolve itself one way or another. As it was, he dared not risk leaving himself open for even the slightest blow. Roran advanced toward the last 2 soldiers, but before he reached them, there was a blur of steel, and then their heads dropped to the cobblestones, surprised expressions on their faces. The bodies collapsed, and behind them, Roran saw the herbalist Angela, garbed in her green and black armor, and carrying her sword staff. Close by her side were a pair of weercats, one in the shape of a brindle-haired girl with sharp, blood-stained teeth and a long dagger, the other in the shape of an animal. He thought it might have been Solemnbum, but he was not sure.
"Roran, how nice to see you," said the herbalist, with a smile that seemed altogether too cheery, considering the circumstances. "Imagine meeting here."
"Better here than in the grave," he shouted,
picking up an extra spear and heaving it at a man farther down the street.
"Well said. I thought you went with Aragorn."
She shook her head.
"He didn't ask me, and I wouldn't have gone if he had. I'm no match for Galbatorix. Besides, Aragorn has the Eldonari to help him."
"You know?"
he asked, shocked. She winked at him from under the lip of her helm.
"I know lots of things."
He grunted and tucked his shoulder behind his shield as he rammed into another group of soldiers. The herbalist and the weercats joined him, as did Horst, Mandel, and several others.
"Where's your hammer?"
shouted Angela, as she spun her bladed staff, blocking and cutting at the same time.
"Lost! I dropped it!"
Someone howled with pain behind him. As soon as he dared, Roran looked back and saw Baldur clutching the stump of his right arm. On the ground, his hand lay twitching. Roran ran back to him, leaping over several corpses along the way. Horst was already by his son's side, fending off the soldier who had severed Baldur's hand. Drawing his dagger, Roran cut a strip of cloth from the tunic of a fallen soldier, then said, "Here," and tied it around the stump of Baldur's arm, stanching the bleeding. The herbalist knelt next to them, and Roran said,
"Can you help him?"
She shook her head.
"Not here. If I use magic, it might end up killing him. If you can get him out of the city, though, the elves can probably save his hand."
Roran hesitated. He was not sure he dared spare anyone to escort Baldur safely out of Urabain. However, without a hand, Baldur would face a hard life, and Roran had no desire to condemn him to that.
"If you won't take him,
I will," bellowed Horst. Roran ducked as a stone the size of a hog flew past overhead and glanced off the front of a house, scattering pieces of masonry through the air. Inside the building, someone screamed.
"No, we need you."
Turning, Roran whistled and picked two warriors, the old cobbler Loring and an Urgle.
"Get him to the elves' healers as fast as you can," he said, pushing Baldur toward them.
As he went, Baldur picked up his hand and tucked it under his hauberk. The Urgle snarled and said in a thick accent that Roran barely understood,
"No, I stay, I fight."
He struck his sword against his shield. Roran stepped over, grabbed one of the creature's horns, and pulled on it until he had twisted the Urgle's head halfway around.
"You'll do as I say," Roran growled. "Besides, it's not an easy task. Protect him and you'll win much glory for you and your tribe."
The Urgle's eyes seemed to brighten.
"Much glory,"
he said, mashing the words between his heavy teeth.
"Much glory," Roran confirmed.
"I do it, Stronghammer."
With a sense of relief, Roran watched the three of them depart, heading toward the outer wall so that they might skirt most of the fighting. He was also pleased to see the human-shaped Weirkat follow after them, the feral, brindle-haired girl swinging her head from side to side as she scented the air. Then another group of soldiers attacked, and all thoughts of Baldur left Roran's mind. He hated fighting with a spear instead of a hammer, but he made do, and after a time, the street again grew calm. He knew the respite would be short. He took the opportunity to sit on the front doorstep of the house and try to regain his breath. The soldiers seemed as fresh as ever, but he could feel exhaustion dragging on his limbs. He doubted he could keep going for much longer without making a fatal mistake. As he sat panting, he listened to the shouts and screams coming from the direction of Urubane's ruined front gate. It was difficult to tell what was happening from the general clamour, but he suspected the Varden were getting pushed back, for the noise seemed to be receding slightly. Amid the commotion, he could hear the regular crack of Lord Bast's mace striking warrior after warrior, and then the increasing cries that invariably followed. Roran made himself stand. If he sat for much longer, his muscles would start to stiffen. A moment after he moved away from the doorstep, the contents of a chamber pot splashed across the spot where he had just been.
"Murderers!"
shouted a woman above him, and then a pair of shutters banged shut. Roran snorted and picked his way around bodies as he led his remaining warriors over to the nearest cross street. They paused wary when a soldier raced past, panic upon his face. Close behind, a pack of yowling house cats chased after him, blood dripping from the fur around their mouths. Roran smiled and started forward again. He stopped a second later when a group of dwarves with red beards ran toward them from deeper within the city.
"Ready yourself,"
one shouted.
"We have a whole pack of soldiers nipping at our heels, a few hundred of them at least."
Roran looked back up the empty cross street.
"Perhaps you're lost,"
he began to say, and then stopped when a line of crimson tunics appeared around the corner of a building a few hundred feet away. More and more soldiers followed, pouring into the street like a swarm of red ants.
"Back!"
Roran shouted.
"Back! We have to find somewhere defensible."
The outer wall was too far away, and none of the houses were large enough to have enclosed courtyards. As Roran ran down the street with his warriors, a dozen or so arrows landed around them. Roran stumbled and fell, writhing, as a bolt of pain shot up his spine from the small of his back. It felt as if someone had jabbed him with a large iron bar. A second later, the herbalist was by his side. She tugged at something behind him, and Roran screamed. Then the pain decreased, and he found himself able to see clearly again. The herbalist showed him an arrow with a bloody tip before throwing it away. "Your mail stopped most of it," she said, as she helped him to his feet. Gritting his teeth, Roran ran with her to rejoin their group. Every step pained him now, and if he bent at the waist too far, his back spasmed, and he found it almost impossible to move. He saw no good places to make a stand, and the soldiers were getting closer, so at last he shouted, "Stop! Form up! Elves to the sides! Urgles front and center!" Roran took his place near the front, along with Darman, Albrecht, the Urgles, and one of the red-bearded dwarves.
"So you are the one they called Stronghammer," said the dwarf, as they watched the advance of the soldiers. "I fought alongside your half-brother in Farthen Dur. It is mine honour to fight with you as well."
Roran grunted. He just hoped he could stay on his feet. Then the soldiers crashed into them, shoving them back through sheer weight. Roran set his shoulder against his shield and pushed with all his might. Swords and spears stuck through the gaps in the wall of overlapping shields. He felt one scrape against his side, but his hauberk protected him. The elves and the Urgles proved invaluable. They broke the soldiers' lines and earned Roran and the other warriors room to swing their weapons. At the edge of his vision, Roran saw the dwarf stabbing the soldiers in the legs, feet and groin, causing many to fall. The supply of soldiers seemed endless, however, and Roran found himself forced backward, step by step. Not even the elves could stem the tide of men, try though they might. Othiara, the elf woman Roran had spoken to outside the city wall, died from an arrow in the neck, and the remaining elves received many wounds. Roran was injured several more times himself, a cut on the upper part of his right calf, which would have hamstrung him if it had been a little bit higher, another cut on the thigh of the same leg, where a sword had slipped under the edge of his hauberk, a nasty scrape on his neck, where he hit himself with his own shield, a stab wound on the inner part of his right leg that fortunately missed the major arteries, and more bruises than he could count. He felt as if every part of himself had been beaten soundly with a wooden mallet, and then a pair of clumsy men had used him as a target for knife-throwing. He dropped back from the front line a few times to rest his arms and catch his breath, but he always rejoined the fight soon afterward. Then the buildings opened up around them, and Roran realized that the soldiers had succeeded in driving them into the square before Urabane's broken gate, and that there were now enemies behind them as well as before them. He chanced to look over his shoulder and saw the elves and the Varden retreating before Bast and his soldiers.
"Right!" shouted Roran. "Right! Up against the buildings!"
He pointed with his bloody spear. With some difficulty, the warriors packed behind him, edged to the side and onto the steps of a huge stone building, fronted with a double row of pillars as tall as any of the trees in the spine. Between the pillars, Roran glimpsed the dark, yawning shape of an open archway, big enough to accommodate Saphira, if not Shrukan.
"Up! Up!"
Roran shouted, and the men, dwarves, elves and Urgles ran with him to the top of the stairs. There they set themselves among the pillars and repelled the wave of soldiers that charged after them. From their vantage point, which was perhaps 20 feet above the level of the streets, Roran saw that the Empire had nearly forced the Varden and the Elves back out the gaping hole in the outer wall.
"We're going to lose," he thought, with sudden desperation.
The soldiers charged up the steps once again. Roran dodged a spear and kicked its owner in the belly, knocking the soldier and two other men down the stairs. From one of the ballistae on a nearby wall tower, a javelin streaked down toward Lord Bast. When it was still a few yards from him, the javelin burst into flames, then crumbled into dust, as did every arrow shot at the armored man.
"We have to kill him," thought Roran.
If Bast fell, then the soldiers would likely break and lose confidence. But given that both the elves and the Kull had failed to stop him, it seemed doubtful that anyone other than Aragorn could. Even as he continued to fight, Roran kept glancing at the large armored figure, hoping to see something that might provide a way to defeat him. He noticed that Bast walked with a slight hitch in his stride,
as if he had once injured his left knee or hip, and the man seemed a hair slower than before. "So he does have his limits," thought Roran, "or rather the Eldunari does." With a shout, he parried the sword of the soldier who had been pressing him. Jerking his shield up, he caught the soldier underneath the jaw, killing the man instantly. Roran was out of breath and faint from his wounds, so he withdrew behind one of the pillars and leaned against it. He coughed and spat. His spittle contained blood, but he thought that was just from where he had bitten the inside of his mouth and not from a punctured lung. At least he hoped so. His ribs felt sore enough that one of them might be broken. A great shout rose from the Varden, and Roran looked around the pillar to see Queen Islanzadi and 11 other elves riding through the battle toward Lord Bast. Again upon Islanzadi's left shoulder sat the White Raven, and he cawed and lifted his wings, the better to balance upon his moving perch. In her hand, Islanzadi carried her sword, while the rest of the elves carried spears, with banners attached close to their leaf-shaped blades. Roran leaned against the pillar, hope rising within him. "Kill him!" he growled. Bast made no move to avoid the elves, but stood waiting for them, with his feet spread wide, and his mace and shield by his sides, as if he had no need to defend himself. Throughout the streets, the fighting slowed to a standstill, as everyone turned to watch what was about to happen. The two elves in the lead lowered their spears, and their horses sprang forward into a gallop, the muscles beneath their glossy hides flexing and relaxing as they raced across the short distance that separated them from Bast. For a moment it looked as if Bast would surely fall. It seemed impossible that anyone on foot could withstand such a charge. The spears never touched Bast. His wards stopped them an arm's length from his body, and the hafts shattered in the elves' hands, leaving them holding useless shards of wood. Then Bast lifted his mace and his shield, and with them he struck the horses on the sides of their heads, breaking their necks and killing them. The horses fell, and the elves upon them jumped free, twisting in the air as they did. The next two elves did not have time to change course before they reached Bast. Like their predecessors, they split their spears on his wards, and then they too jumped free of their horses as Bast struck the animals down. By then, the 8 other elves, including Islanzadi, had managed to turn and rein in their steeds. They trotted in a circle around Bast, keeping their weapons pointed at him, while the 4 elves on the ground drew their swords and cautiously advanced toward Bast. The man laughed and hefted his shield as he prepared for their attack. The light caught his face under his helm, and even from a distance, Roran could see that it was broad and heavy-browed, with prominent cheekbones. In some ways, it reminded him of the face of an Urgle. The 4 elves ran at Bast, each from a different direction, and they cut and stabbed at him in unison. Bast caught one of the swords on his shield, deflected another with his mace, and let his wards stop the blades of the 2 elves behind him. He laughed again and swung his weapon. A silver-haired elf threw himself to the side, and the mace flew past harmlessly. Twice more Bast swung, and twice more the elves evaded him. Bast showed no signs of frustration, but hunched behind his shield and bided his time, like a cave bear waiting for whosoever might be foolish enough to venture into his lair. Outside the ring of elves, a block of halberd-wielding soldiers took it upon themselves to run screaming toward Queen Islanzadi and her companions. Without pause, the queen lifted her sword over her head, and at her signal, a swarm of buzzing arrows shot out from the ranks of the Varden and felled the soldiers. Roran shouted with excitement, along with many of the Varden. Bast had been edging ever closer to the bodies of the 4 horses he had slain, and now he stepped into their midst so that the bodies formed a low, tumbled wall on either side of him. The elves to his left and right would have no choice but to leap over the horses if they wished to attack him. "Clever," Roran thought, frowning. The elf in front of Bast darted forward, shouting something in the ancient language. Bast seemed to hesitate, and his hesitation encouraged the elf to come closer. Then Bast lunged forward, his mace came crashing down, and the elf crumpled to the ground, broken. A groan went up from the elves. The three remaining elves on foot were more cautious thereafter. They continued to circle Bast, running in to attack him on occasion, but mostly keeping their distance.
"Surrender!" exclaimed Islan Zadi, and her voice could be heard throughout the streets. "There are more of us than you. No matter how strong you are, in time you will tire, and your wards will fail. You cannot win, human."
"No,"
said Bast. He straightened and dropped his shield with a loud clatter. Sudden dread filled Roran. "Run," he thought. "Run," he shouted a half-second later. He was too late. Bending at the knees, Bast grabbed the neck of one of the horses and with his left arm alone threw the horse at Queen Islanzadi. If she spoke in the ancient language, Roran did not hear it. But she lifted her hand, and the body of the horse stopped in mid-air, then dropped to the cobblestones, where it landed with an unpleasant sound. On her shoulder, the raven screeched. Bast was not looking, however. As soon as the carcass left his hand, he scooped up his shield and sprinted toward the nearest of the mounted elven riders. One of the three remaining elves on foot, a woman with a red sash tied around her upper arm, ran toward him and slashed at his back. Bast ignored her. Over a flat stretch of land, the elves' horses might have been able to outdistance Bast, but in the limited space between the buildings and the closely packed warriors, Bast was both faster and more nimble. He rammed his shoulder into the ribs of one of the horses, toppling it over, and then swung his mace at an elf upon another horse, knocking the elf from his seat. A horse screamed. The circle of elven riders disintegrated, each turning in a different direction as they tried to calm their mounts and address the threat before them. A half-dozen elves ran out from the nearby press of warriors and surrounded Bast, all hacking at him with frenzied speed. Bast disappeared behind them for a moment. Then his mace rose up, and three of the elves flew tumbling away. Then another two, and Bast strode forward, blood and gore clinging to the flanges of his black weapon.
"Now!"
roared Bast. And throughout the square, hundreds of soldiers ran forward and assailed the elves, forcing them to defend themselves.
"No!"
Roran growled, agonized. He would have gone with his warriors to help, but too many bodies, both living and dead, separated them from Bast and the elves. He glanced over at the herbalist, who looked as worried as he felt, and said,
"Can't you do something?"
"I could, but it would mean my life and that of everyone here.
Galbatorix as well?
He's too well shielded, but our army would be destroyed, along with most everyone in Urubane, and even those at our camp might die. Is that what you want?"
Roran shook his head.
"I thought not."
Moving with uncanny speed, Bast struck elf after elf, felling them with ease. With one of his swings, he caught the shoulder of the elf woman with the red sash and knocked her sprawling onto her back. She pointed at Bast and screamed in the ancient language, but the spell went awry, for another elf slumped forward and toppled out of his saddle. The front of his body split from head to seam. Bast slew the elf woman with a jab of his mace, and then continued to run from horse to horse until he reached Islanzadi on her white mare. The elf queen did not wait for Bast to kill her steed. She leaped out of her saddle, her red cape billowing, and her companion, the white raven, beat his wings as he took flight from her shoulder. Before she alit, Islanzadi lashed out at Bast, her sword a streak of shining steel. Her blade rang as it collided with his wards. Bast retaliated with a counterstroke, which Islanzadi parried with a deft turn of her wrist, sending the spiked ball of his mace crashing into the cobblestones. Around them a space formed, as friend and foe alike paused to watch them duel. Overhead, the raven circled, shrieking and cursing,
in the harsh manner of his kind. Never had Roran seen such a fight. The blows from both Islanzadi and Bast were too fast to follow. Only a blur was visible when they struck, and the sound of their weapons clashing was louder than all of the other noises in the city. Again and again, Bast tried to crush Islanzadi with his mace, even as he had crushed the other elves. But she was too fast for him to catch, and she seemed, if not his equal in strength, at least strong enough to knock aside his blows without difficulty. The other elves, Roran thought, must be aiding her, for she appeared not to tire, despite her exertions. Akal and two elves joined Islanzadi. Bast paid them no mind, other than to kill them one by one, when they made the mistake of venturing within his reach. Roran found himself gripping the pillar so hard, his hands began to cramp. Minutes passed as Islanzadi and Bast fought back and forth across the street. In motion, the Elf Queen was glorious, swift, lithe, and powerful. Unlike Bast, she could not afford to make a single mistake, nor did she, for her wards would not protect her. With every moment, Roran's admiration for Islanzadi increased, and he felt he was witnessing a battle that would be sung about for centuries to come. The raven often dove at Bast, seeking to distract him from Islanzadi. After the raven's first few attempts, Bast ignored the bird, for the maddened creature could not touch him, and it took pains to keep away from his mace. The raven seemed to grow frustrated. It shrieked louder and more frequently, and was bolder with its attacks, and with each sally, it edged ever closer to Bast's head and neck. Finally, as the bird again swooped past Bast, the man twisted his mace upward, changing its path in midair, and clipped the raven on its right wing. The bird cried out in pain and dropped a foot toward the ground, before struggling to climb back into the sky. Bast swung at the raven again, but Islanzadi stopped his mace with her sword, and they stood facing each other, with their weapons locked together at the top, the blade of her sword wedged between the flanges of his mace. Elf and human swayed as they pushed against one another. Neither was able to gain the advantage. Then Queen Islanzadi shouted a word in the ancient language, and where their weapons met, a harsh, brilliant light shone forth. Squinting, Roran shaded his eyes with his hand and averted his gaze. For a minute, the only sounds were the cries of the wounded and a ringing, bell-like tone that grew louder and louder until it was nearly unbearable. To the side, Roran saw the weercat with Angela cringing and covering its tasseled ears with its paws. When the sound was at the very height of its intensity, the blade of Islanzadi's sword cracked, and the light and the bell-like tone vanished. Then the Elf Queen smote at Bast's face with the broken end of her sword, and she said, "Thus I curse you, Bast, son of Berengar!" Bast allowed her sword to fall upon his wards. Then he swung his mace once more and caught Queen Islanzadi between her neck and her shoulder, and she collapsed to the ground, blood staining her corselet of golden scale armor, and all was still. The white raven circled once over Islanzadi's body and uttered a doleful cry, then flew slowly toward the breach in the outer wall, the feathers of its wounded wing red and crumpled. A great wail went up from the Varden. Throughout the streets, men cast down their weapons and fled. The elves shouted with rage and grief, a most terrible sound, and every elf with a bow began to fire arrows toward Bast. The arrows burst into flame before they touched him. A dozen elves charged him, but he swatted them aside as if they weighed no more than children. In that moment, another five elves darted in, lifted up Islanzadi's body, and bore her away upon their leaf-shaped shields. A sense of disbelief gripped Roran. Of them all, Islanzadi was the one he had least expected to die. He glared at the men who were fleeing and silently cursed them for traitors and cowards. Then he returned his gaze to Bast, who was rallying his troops
in preparation for driving the Vardan and their allies back out of Urabain. The pit in Roran's stomach grew larger. The elves might continue to fight, but the men, dwarves and Urgals, no longer had a taste for battle. He could see it in their faces. They would break and retreat, and Bast would slaughter them by the hundreds from behind. Nor, Roran was sure, would Bast halt at the city walls. No, he would continue onto the fields beyond and chase the Vardan back to their camp, scattering and killing as many as he could. It was what Roran would do. Worse, if Bast reached the camp, Katrina would be in danger, and Roran had no illusions as to what would happen if the soldiers caught her. Roran stared down at his bloody hands. Bast had to be stopped, but how? Roran thought and he thought, running through everything he knew about magic, until, at last, he remembered how it had felt when the soldiers were holding him and striking him. Roran took a deep, shuddering breath. There was a way, but it was dangerous, incredibly dangerous. If he did what he was contemplating, he knew that he would probably never see Katrina again, much less their unborn child. Yet the knowledge brought him a certain peace. His life for theirs was a fair trade, and if he could help save the Vardan at the same time, then he would be happy to give it. Katrina. The decision was an easy one. Raising his head, he strode over to the herbalist. She looked as shocked and grief-ridden as any of the elves. He touched her on the shoulder with the edge of his shield and said, "I need your help." She gazed at him with red-rimmed eyes. "What do you intend to do?" "Kill Bast." His words captivated all of the warriors nearby.
"Roran, no!"
exclaimed Horst. The herbalist nodded. "I'll help however I can."
"Good. I want you to fetch Jormungandr, Garshvaag, Oryk, Grimmer, and one of the elves who still has some authority."
The curly-haired woman sniffed and wiped her eyes.
"Where do you want them to meet you?"
"Right here. And hurry, before any more men flee."
Angela nodded, then she and the Weercat trotted away, sticking close to the sides of the buildings for protection.
"Roran," said Horst, clutching his arm, "what do you have in mind?"
"I'm not going to go up against him by myself, if that's what you're thinking," said Roran, nodding toward Bast.
Horst appeared somewhat relieved.
"Then what are you going to do?"
"You'll see."
Several soldiers carrying pikes ran up the steps of the building, but the red-haired dwarves who had joined Roran's force held them off with ease, the steps for once giving them the advantage of height over their opponents. While the dwarves fenced with the soldiers, Roran went to a nearby elf, who, with a snarl fixed on his face, was emptying his quiver at a prodigious speed, sending each of his arrows arcing toward Bast. None of them, of course, found their mark.
"Enough," said Roran.
When the dark-haired elf ignored him, Roran grabbed the elf's right hand, his bow hand, and pulled it to the side.
"That's enough," I said. "Save your arrows."
A growl sounded, and then Roran felt a hand around his throat.
"Do not touch me, human. Listen to me. I can help you kill Bast. Just let me go."
After a second or two, the fingers gripping Roran's neck relaxed.
"How, Stronghammer?"
The bloodthirstiness of the elf's voice contrasted with the tears on his cheeks.
"You'll find out in a minute. But I have a question for you first. Why can't you kill Bast with your minds? He's only one man, and there are so many of you."
An anguished expression crossed the elf's face.
"Because his mind is hidden from us."
"How?"
"I do not know. We can feel nothing of his thoughts. It is as if there is a sphere around his mind. We can see nothing within the sphere, nor can we pierce it."
Roran had expected something like that.
"Thank you," he said,
and the elf made a slight motion of his head in acknowledgement. Garshvaag was the first